Hi, this is Matt Barnett. I'm the founder and Papa Bear at Bonjouro, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. It's 2021, so let's show some love to a few startups that have taken me up on my offer for a free plug in this show. The first spotlight goes to Brandon Brown at AG Headwear. He writes, "Absolutely loving these podcast episodes, and it's so great listening to founder stories as I get work done. I hope one day to get on the podcast once the company I have founded, AG Headwear, grows. If you ever need minimalist headwear, which is built to perform, make sure to check out agheadwear.com. Thanks so much for the review, Brandon, and I look forward to tracking the success of AG Headwear. For everyone listening, make sure to visit agheadwear.com and check out the latest designs. I love that AG stands for always going. Brandon, if you ever make a hat that reads something to the effect of always grinding, hit me up on that one. You know, it's a small world, but we have another review from another Brandon. This time it is Brandon Stover. And Brandon Stover writes, "The Startup Story is one of my favorite podcasts to listen to weekly. James is a phenomenal storyteller and does a fantastic job revealing each entrepreneur's true passions while mining out the key insights we all need to succeed as entrepreneurs." Well, thank you for that, Brandon. And for all those listening, Brandon Stover has a podcast of his own titled Evolve. And I was a recent guest on the Evolve podcast. You can listen to it via the link we will include in our show notes. And if you want to plug your brand in an upcoming episode of The Startup Story, then make sure to leave a written review on Apple Podcasts and make sure to plug your brand in that written review. That way, when I read your review in an episode, it'll be like a free ad within an episode of The Startup Story. And speaking of advertising, brands that have advertised in The Startup Story have seen results that exceed all expectations. Brands like Brex, the credit card for startups, and Design Pickle, the flat rate design service, have both come back and said the ROI from advertising with The Startup Story surpasses campaigns they've run with shows 10 times the size of The Startup Story. If you want to share your brand, product, or service with The Startup Story audience, then drop an email to advertise@thestartupstory.co. And like always, we'll include this in the show notes. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Matt Barnett, the founder of Bonjouro. Bonjouro is a customer or lead engagement platform like you've never experienced. Bonjouro integrates private video messages within your current marketing and funnel strategies. Imagine the increased level of engagement and brand affinity that you will develop with a new lead if they received a video message from you within minutes of filling out your lead capture form. Or imagine if your e-commerce brand leveraged Bonjouro to say hello to an abandoned cart transaction. Think about the level of trust that would develop with your buyer. You've now just taken the e-commerce transaction from a simple buy-sell engagement and leveled it up to an early stage relationship. All of this helps to build and scale your business, and we haven't even mentioned how Bonjouro could be leveraged for customer onboarding. The potential to elevate your brand relationship with your clients by using Bonjouro is remarkable. And in this episode, we do have Matt Barnett, Bonjouro's founder, break down some of his key strategies in using Bonjouro. But like all episodes of The Startup Story, we really seek to understand all the twists and turns a founder has endured to get to where they are today. It's those stories that never get told because every journalist is chasing the media headline of a nine-figure venture capital raise or an IPO announcement. Yet even before all of those attention-stopping headlines, The Startup Story actually begins decades before then. In fact, it begins in the childhood years.
I had no hope. My father ran the world's biggest crossbow and archery company, which is now still going in the States, run by my brother, called Barnett. So very much not the industry that I'm in.
Yeah.
But I think you grow up around that and you see that, honestly, just the fun of running a business and kind of what that could bring, you know, the travel and the opportunity and just the excitement of being, you know, kind of creative out there in the world. So yeah, I had no hope, unfortunately.
So when you were growing up though, do you remember saying to yourself, I want that, I want to run my own business? Or was there some challenges within your dad's entrepreneurial story? You were like, I don't want that. That's just a hot mess.
I don't think when you're young, you realize, you know, now I'm older, I look back and reflect and I'm like, I remember him walking the streets at 5 a.m. in the morning. I just thought he liked walking. I was like, nope, that's because things were tough. So you understand more of it now when you're in the same shoes as a young man or as a child. You don't. So I had a choice of zoology or business. I figured I would go into business, build a fund, and use that to go and impact zoology. I thought that's probably the way that I can make the biggest personal impact rather than going in on my hands and knees as a scientist. So that was always a pretty easy decision.
That's interesting. So coming into the end of your high school era, you were thinking about science. I mean, zoology was part of your trek, what you were interested in.
Yeah, I've got a kind of weird brain. So I ended up studying industrial design, which is kind of product design, which has this weird, like the artistic side and then the kind of like scientific side. So those two mix together, it's a bit of a weird head. So the science is always part of it. And then making impact is part of that. So business, I felt, could do the creative and the kind of mathematical scientific side, like you do meld them together. Again, in hindsight, I look and I go, zoology could have done that too. So I don't think it's so much the industry you pick and direction you take as to what you do with it over the time when you have it. It's all about the journey, not really the destination.
Yeah, no, and I agree. So as you were ending your high school years, going into the university, what was your pursuit? When you jumped into day one of college, those are two very different treks. I mean, science versus business. Like, what trek were you on at that time?
Well, I chose industrial design, which was product design. Yeah. But having come from a background where the family was making products and design products, obviously the first thought was, let's learn that skill. Let's get into CAD and kind of the stuff that they weren't doing, to use that to come out with a product and then use that product as a basis to go and start a business. So my intention was always end university, have a product ready to go, and then we'll work out the business stuff afterwards. So it's kind of starting with the product first, which is how I think a lot of businesses start. You kind of start with the products and the business stuff. You just like, you can't learn it in university. You gotta kind of learn it on the ground. So yes. I assumed that would happen, and ultimately it did.
So when you think back to your college years, and real quick, just for a frame of reference, how old are you, Matt?
36.
36. Okay. So, we'll say 15 years ago in college, what were some of your early product designs that you thought, this is probably what I'm going to run with from a business perspective?
So the one that we were going to run with, we actually designed a paintbrush with a lid. So it sounds kind of stupid, but it was, and this is a commercial paintbrush. The idea was, obviously, cleaning paintbrushes every day, huge waste for environment, but also for just getting rid of bristles, paintbrushes breaking, everything else, waste. Yeah. And we looked into it for 6 months. We came up with the idea of just putting a lid on it, like a pen, and it would stay wet and you could use it the next day.
What happened with that?
At university, myself and one of my other colleagues were going to go ahead with this, and he got cold feet last minute. We actually got investments. We actually got offered investment from a university panel. We went and did a few competitions, won them all. And he got cold feet last minute and went and took a job. And I didn't feel at the time that I could go ahead without him. I thought it was wrong to take his idea. I mean, now, again, hindsight, I'd be like, yep, I've taken that. Like, it's your fault. But at the time, I was like, it was our idea together. I didn't feel comfortable doing it without him. So I went off and kind of did my own thing from that point. I guess one of the learnings I had is a lot of creatives, and design is obviously a creative industry, struggled to come into business, that they, like everyone knew, went into jobs because they wanted the approval and the kind of recognition. But now at this age, plenty of them have come back into business, which is great to see.
That's awesome. You bring up a good point about the nature of creatives. Business needs to have some boundaries to it, and that's kind of counterintuitive for a creative. The ability to think through and ideate without boundaries and limits is really what most creatives love. Like, I have a friend who's a video game designer, one of the founding partners of Treyarch. He loves video games because the worlds are limitless. And so when you try to create them into a confine with limits, it's frustrating to him. So for yourself that's in the creative space, making that translation into business and monetizing. And again, pitching's one thing, right? Having a great idea, pitching it for what it could be. What was that translation process like for you to put a business plan around this paintbrush idea in order to pitch? Because pitching, you're not just pitching a product, you're pitching a business.
With that mindset where you have the kind of like the science, math side and the creative side, like you can actually meld that together pretty well. So I'd say anyone who's kind of come from a, especially industrial design, which is like a lot of it's engineering, yeah? So it is very much on that side. I actually think you have a great brain for this. That said, I also think business is creative. Creativity can have limits, yeah? I mean, that's part of what limits can drive creativity. This is the whole point, working within limits gets new ideas out the door. So again, like when you're young, there are no limits. I always remember that there was a lecturer, so the head of design ran a large consultancy, like a very successful large consultancy. And the one day I asked him, I was like, why do you bother lecturing still? Like, I don't understand it. Like, it doesn't make sense to me. If you're not successful, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And he was like, you guys have that. He literally said, like, you have no limits. And he said, that helps me in my job be more creative, because I see where you guys are going. Oh, wow. You're not constrained by, oh, you can't manufacture this, you can't do this, like, this won't sell. He's like, it's wonderful. But then obviously he would take that to inspire himself and get his creativity up for his normal job. I think limits are not a barrier to creativity. I think they help.
That's awesome. And I love that. I love that you had someone model that for you with your lecturer to come back and say, I am challenged and encouraged by seeing you guys think limitlessly, as he breaks it into his agency. And I love that. You know, that's a lot of what the Startup Story brings, is bringing other thoughts to the table so that those listening can have their expanded thoughts on how to tackle a challenge or obstacle that they have in front of them. So when you think of your time at the end of university, what was your next step? I mean, did you come out the gate running your own business, or what was step number one for you?
So I think we would have done with that, with the idea of the paintbrush idea, but again, we didn't. So I jumped into a consultancy for a year and a half. It's the only real job I've ever had. So I went into a design consultancy and I just kind of took over a lot of it. I came in and I was like, right, we're going to rebrand your whole company. We're going to do your new websites. And I was doing design as well. I went through and then I was like, right, we're going to photograph like all your products. Like, because their brand was, it was great consultancy, but the brand had aged. So I was like, look, as well as designing the products and working on that, I'm going to go and do everything else. Like, I was there till midnight, like a lot of nights, just getting as much out of it as I could, which they were very happy for. So like, obviously I benefited them a lot, but I just wanted to learn everything I could. I didn't just want to do product design. I wanted to do all the other things that come with business. So I wanted to drive myself into that. So I shamelessly used it as an opportunity to get my head around the aspects that weren't just the product design stuff.
It's a new year with new challenges and new opportunities. Do you have the resources necessary to fuel your grind? That is exactly why Grindology was created. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter and delivers 2 bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, hustler, entrepreneur, maker, and creator. Each shipment will include an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. And lastly, and arguably most importantly, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of the Grindology Tactical Manual, we will be delivering to you tactics and strategies you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive real marketing funnel strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies that they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that will be found in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. Everything about Grindology is about helping to fuel your grind. And that is why our friends at Design Pickle have partnered with our first shipment by hooking up one lucky subscriber with a full year of unlimited graphic design services. You can visit Grindology.com to learn more. We ship our first box this month, and it will be an exclusive shipment, so make sure to secure your box today at Grindology.com. And we'll, of course, like always, we will include a link to Grindology.com within our show notes for easy access. Now let's get back to our episode.
I shamelessly used it as an opportunity to get my head around the aspects that weren't just the product design stuff.
You know, looking back now, you can see how you leveraged that season to prepare you, especially coming into an existing agency, really thinking about it as though it was your own agency, making the changes that you would make to it if it was yours from day one. But again, a lot of that is hindsight. In the moment, did you really recognize this as an opportunity? Because you knew this was temporary. I'm going to have my own thing at some point in time. I want to milk this for all it's worth to learn about all the different areas of running this agency or this business. Was that intentional, or looking back, you see that you had that subconsciously?
I just went after all their challenges. So I was excited by all the challenges and the things where I saw they could do better. So I wanted to get my hands into those. I didn't necessarily think I was building a playbook to start my own business. If I'm going to be here, if I'm going to do this, I want to do everything. Like, I want to try all the things. Yeah. And again, like, great. Like, I'm like, this company could be better if we change these things. So like, I'll go and change them and see if it works. So part of it was experimentation again, hindsight, you realize what you're doing. You're trying, you're getting across all parts of it, because anything you haven't done before is like, to me, it's exciting. I'm like, I don't know about this. Therefore, like the learning curve is what drives us. Like that learning curve, I was like, how can I make this go steeper? Because that's more exciting to me. And so I would go and do that. Again, it gave me a playbook, but I would also ask them about finances and also be trying to work out how much projects cost and where, you know, how much profit they made and how it all worked. And could we hire someone? And so like, I helped them go and like hire a couple more juniors. I was like, we should bring them in, they're cheaper. So I started to try to get my hands into everything, and they were wonderful, and they let me do this, and they supported me for that. So again, ever grateful for that experience.
That's great. You know, it's one of the things you talk about, the learning curve is what drives you. I remember back to an interview I had with Steve Jurvetson, one of the, maybe the first investor in SpaceX and Tesla, good friend of Elon Musk. He talks about the reason that he knew venture capital was his trajectory is because he never wanted to stop learning. And for him, he looked at a job as having a finite learning potential to it within the confines of a job. And then he said, well, why don't I just run my own business? And he said, well, if I run my own business, there's still a limit to what I can learn within that business, because you can't just continue to create infinite products and infinite industries. He's like, so I knew venture capital was for me because I wanted the infinite learning. It's an incredible interview with Steve Jurvetson to talk about the infinite learning. And you talk about that idea of the learning curve driving us. I mean, I think a lot of what makes entrepreneurship exciting for those who aren't in it is the idea of it seems infinite in what we can learn and what we can do. And then when you're in it, there's a whole lot of layers to entrepreneurship that most people aren't aware of. And that's why we have the startup story to unpack those layers. So how long were you with this agency before you did your own thing?
I was with them for a year and then moved back to London and worked remote with them for maybe on and off for kind of a year after that, where I started to set my own agency up. So I moved out of the city, did contract work with them, used it as a basis to start my own agency, started to build a bit of an agency there, decided that agency was not the kind of business I wanted to run.
Now, why is that? Now, again, having been part of an agency, really helping run the agency and make a lot of changes in the agency, why did it take you to do your own thing to realize I don't want to run an agency?
Doing the creativity for clients killed a little bit of it for me. I was like, okay, right, like I've got someone to answer to. So call it an authority complex or whatever you like. I don't like answering for other people. So an interesting year, it was also about the time that the GFC, like the global financial crisis kind of hit, which was good because it meant it was harder. And so again, that learning curve was a lot steeper. Yeah. You know, when I saw things and decisions being made, I was like, I would make this decision. And this is you should do this idea, not this idea. And if I was doing it. And so I think I got to the stage where I was like, we need to be doing my ideas, not theirs.
So you mentioned an interesting time period. You talk about the global financial crisis, which tells me we're talking around the 2008, 2010 era is when we're speaking of this time. An incredibly challenging time for all businesses. I mean, the greatest recession in U.S. history, obviously Europe heavily impacted as well. And here you are in the midst of it in product design. In that season, what did you learn about what your future was going to look like based on that season of turmoil in 2008, 2010?
I ended up learning how to sell and have a network, which from where I come from wasn't something we ever had experience in. Universities at the time at least failed because it's always how to design products. Then they never taught you how to sell them or how to like build businesses or raise money or do any of that. So this is kind of like, again, like a hole in my experience at the time. So I ended up joining a lot of networking groups. I was 23. So I'd be the youngest guy at pretty much every single one. I was a little bit of an odd child. I'd start wearing a kilt for most of them, a kilt and a suit. And everyone's like, who is this guy? And I just go on and I just like was like, again, like, how do we like ramp up this experience? So I would go do everything I could. I ended up running a networking group in London, again, very young, with an older mentor as well alongside me. It kind of helped. I just kind of got myself into that learning experience of how do you sell? How do you build? And so I got customers and clients through that. And that was a pretty, again, like a year of very hard learning, very quick learning.
Yeah.
The GFC, because I didn't have experience of the market before that, I was like, oh man, the selling's really hard. Like I look back and I'm like, would it have been as hard before that time? I imagine not, but it was all I knew. So I was like, doesn't matter. I have to make this work. Like I have to be able to feed myself and pay my rent. You do that because you need to. So like, I loved it. I think the GFC was, I learned more about it in the years afterwards than when I was in it.
Perspective is everything. It's funny. I mean, you mentioned that, right? I mean, selling technical solutions before that, it was the heyday. not anybody could figure out a way to build a technical solution. And then all of a sudden it comes through, the GFC comes through, and now everyone's looking at technical solutions like, do we need to spend this now? What is the answer to this? And so anyone who was just cutting their teeth, much like I assume realtors and real estate at the time, if you were cutting your teeth in that market, you were really set up for when things started to recover because it just got easier for you. But again, then the propensity is, okay, I never need to work that hard again because that was the worst economic period globally ever. And then all of a sudden COVID comes around and reframes everyone's thoughts again. But we'll get to that in a second on how that changes things. So coming out of the GFC, when did you start thinking through what your next steps were going to be, being that you didn't want an agency? That was something you very clearly said, I don't want. So that removes that from the list of opportunities and possibilities. What started percolating then?
So I actually decided to move to Australia from the UK. So I moved over here. Part of me was just getting away to a new country. Like, again, the experience and learning curve. I was like, I want to go do this overseas for a while, leave my own and kind of make my own way. So I looked at ways to get here. Australia's not the easiest country to get into.
Why is that? Why is that comment? I don't think people would consider that a factor. I mean, why did you say that?
So at the time, with the global financial crisis, they were not, there was very little, there was like three jobs on the skilled visa list to get in. It goes to fluctuations. So Australia's a very new country. It's a very young country. Population growth is important to it, but it does it very staged and very measured. So there'll be periods like in the 60s where they were getting as many people from the UK and Ireland as they could. And then in this period, they pretty much shut the borders. And so getting in and getting a visa and being allowed to stay. I mean, like getting a green card in the States is also hard. Yeah. Yeah, like I think staying in the UK is also, so again, like it's not anywhere as easy. At the time, Australia was doing well in the whole financial crisis, like comparatively. It's probably one of the countries that did the best like globally.
Okay.
The crisis here was never really a crisis. I didn't know this at the time.
Yeah.
But I looked to leave, partly personal. Like I used to surf off Scotland and I got sick of surfing in the snow. I was like February, one day we're sitting on this beach and it's hailing so hard, it's like denting my board and like my face doesn't work. And I just thought, enough. So I left, came over here, looked for a way in, did an MBA to get a visa. I also figured because of my background, most of the people I hung around with were creatives and then small business owners. And I thought, look, if they're doing an MBA, I'll hang out with a bunch of people who are not anything like me, which turned out to be completely true. I think there were two creatives out of like a cohort of 60.
Interesting.
In there. And I figured to use that as a stepping stone to get here, put a base down, and then decide what business I was going to go and start.
Let's put a timestamp on this. When did you complete your MBA?
So I finished 2012, mid-2012.
Mid-2012. You're surrounded by more people that are not creative than you are surrounded by creatives. So what were you thinking you wanted to build for yourself coming into 2012?
I assumed I would go into tangible products. Again, like from the design background, I assume that's where I would go. And I wanted to meet people who were, again, like doing an MBA, that the MBA average age was probably 32. I think I was 26. So everyone was a bit older again. Which comes back to the learning curve thing. You kind of push yourself ahead. Yeah. I imagine there's a good chance I start the business partner. I'd be like, oh, let's find someone who's more on the business side. That ended up being me anyway. So, but I thought I'd get into products. And coming out of it, I ended up in tech. So I ended up finding a technical co-founder and starting a technical company, so an online software company.
Does that lead us to Bonjoro?
It takes a while.
I love it. So this first technical solution, again, you not being a technical person, you found a technical co-founder. What was that first technical solution that you wanted to create? And I'm asking this question because now we're finding ourselves in 2012, 2013. There are developers everywhere. It's a pretty hot, let me think here real quick, 2012, 2013. The app phase had long gone as far as you know it being a super hot, make an app and become a millionaire. Facebook had been around, is around. Instagram is around. There's a lot of things that we know today that really started on the tail end of that period.
Smartphones are just starting. That was the kind of period.
So I mean, iPhone had been around, 5 years at that point? Like 5-6 years at that point, I think, you know, iPhone at least really picking that up. So what was your technical solution?
We decided to go into B2C products, as I think everyone does the first time they try it. and the idea was to do family life stories. So recording videos of family members answering questions, doing interviews, and then recording that online. So if you like, have a mobile video-based ancestry book. So you could do an interview and save, you know, your grandmother for the future generations.
That's interesting.
And it was a super, like, so a very emotional idea, very good. We raised money for it. We had our pitch down perfect. We raised funds. We got into it. I don't know if the audience tell the story, but I remember going to the States, the Valley's pitch as well. And by the way, like Australia, so we talk about where technology was. Australia had its first wave of startups starting to happen. So Australia was definitely behind.
Okay.
It was not on the front foot at all. There was a very small investment community here.
Okay.
Atlassian existed.
Okay.
But then beyond that, you had the first kind of cohorts of starting to come through and be supported. Like the first ever startup space was only in 2012.
Oh,
it's kind
wow.
of crazy late.
Wow.
So we ended up going to the Valley, like you ended up bouncing back and forth to the States quite a lot, you know, pitched there. But I remember meeting someone there who was like, we tried to do this and it's really, really hard. And he told me all the reasons why it wouldn't work. And I was like, sure, mate, don't worry, we'll make it work. So again, hindsight, like listen to people.
As soon as you said you met someone who tried and talked about how hard it is, I knew the words that were going to come out of your mouth because I have spoken them myself. I know how to solve around that challenge, or that challenge is unique to you. I've got a solution for it. But yeah, you're right. Listen to what people are saying and learn from them. So the idea of what you just talked about is super interesting. From obviously there's an emotional appeal too. I think of ancestry.com, but a video version yeah. of it, like how you can build out a family tree through video. I think that's, wow, super interesting and compelling. What went wrong with it that we aren't talking about that today? What happened there?
Yeah, so we used mobile. So we went to mobile video as well. And this was early, so video, so like data, I think we were 2 or 3G at the time, so data transfer was always a yeah. challenge. We're starting to get mobile video apps, but we built them out and they worked. It wasn't the easiest, but there was a key assumption that we made, which was completely and utterly flawed, which was the urgency to go and record these videos. And so again, like also very naive, hadn't had experience within that industry. And there are ways to overcome this with, you know, negative marketing and the ways that other companies do it. So like, I actually think you can do it now, like with hindsight, but at the time, everyone told us it was amazing. We actually sold a lot of it. And so the assumption there is it's obviously going to work. And then what we found is that activation was non-existent. Because people would be like, oh, look, I'll get around to doing it. And then grandma would get ill and they're like, I don't want to do it now because I don't want to remember her when she's ill. And so we had this real struggle with activation.
Interesting.
And again, like where I am now, I look back and I'm like, there's ways to drive activation. There's ways to do this. But at the time we didn't have the experience. And so we couldn't get activation. We couldn't bring like money enough for those first subscriptions. Then it continued, the churn kind of went up and my co-founder imploded a little bit. Like it all kind of blew up as it does. It blew up fairly quickly. It took like we went for like a year and a half, 2 years
okay.
until it all kind of like ended. So it was good. But at the same point, coming into an industry I had no idea about
yeah.
and being quite naive, I kind of look and I'm like, it's almost inevitable that was going to happen. I'm not even 80-20. I think the first time it's probably like 95% chance that first one doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yep. And what's interesting though, now knowing that we're talking today because of Bonjoro, the fact that your first technical was still video-based. So I want to ask this question, truly not knowing the answer to it, but does your second startup then stay in video and everything in between stay in video till we get to Bonjoro?
Yeah, it does.
See, that's what I find so fascinating about the entrepreneurial journey is that even in the midst of the failure of that ancestry solution, you saw something in video that still captured your interest to try and solve for startup number two and whatever, however many more there are until Bonjoro. And so coming off of that failure of the first one, what was the second startup and what changes did you make in your approach to your second technical solution?
The second one came out of the ashes. It's called Verbate, but it actually still runs today. So we salvaged some of that and we took it into a B2B environment. And this was born purely for hunch and we actually put funds in and tried to keep this thing going. I felt we had more obligation to investors to not lose everything.
Yeah.
So we took it into research. I was like, look, we have a system here that we can get video of people and upload it online. I wonder if that'd be interesting for qualitative research. And so you look at this and I go, well, I actually do have some experience there because of product design. We did a lot of qual research. Focus groups are expensive. And I was like, is there not a way here that we can get people to take us around their homes, how they're using packaging and products, you know, in India and Japan and China and Germany and have it all online the next day and use it as a research source. And it turns out that was correct. We could do that. So we basically salvaged it. We had our first paying client, which was almost on the old technology, and we kind of like got through and we made like $5,000 and we're like, oh, this is interesting. And then we got another one and made kind of 10 grand and be like, okay, this is, we like money. Money's the, by this point I was like, okay, doesn't make money, doesn't make sense. And we started to fall into B2B, which given the experience I've had like in London was actually a lot easier for me. So the sales, like you could go out and sell.
Yeah.
At the time I was very like, I was good at sales, so we could do this. And then we started to build our business, and we ended up with all our clients in New York, Paris, and London, even though we were based in Australia. And we ended up selling to large agencies and to FMCG companies who would want to see Huggies releasing new products. And they want to see how mothers use Huggies in third world countries. And so we would allow people to upload videos, diaries, and that would be used. And we'd pull all the text out and do analysis, etc. But essentially, it was kind of the same cool concept. But all this will lead through the whole idea of like deep industry expertise as a way to succeed. Because what we were building is expertise in almost not the technology wasn't that hard. Like I wouldn't say video technology is the hardest thing in the world, but I think understanding how people use video, what video can be used for beyond film and TV, which is where video was at the time, except for maybe Skype, which was starting to connect families together. So suddenly you start to see video as a communication tool and as a data tool. And that understanding, and so we kind of invested and kind of went down that rabbit hole for a couple of years.
And so you're with that, you're working that business solution for a couple of years. It's still in existence. So did you sell your stake out? Are you still part of it? I mean, how did you move on beyond that?
So, I can talk about the kind of Bonjour origin story because it comes out of this at this point. So I think this is a pretty good time. So we were here running it. We were having leads coming in overnight. And so one of the things we did was look at better ways to convert those. Originally we used to use Intercom and drip feeds, and that actually worked pretty well back in kind of 2016, maybe 2015. And then kind of like engagement rates start to drop off. And because we were in the wrong time zones, we couldn't get on the phone and call people. We couldn't put around to the office and see people. And I'm very much a jazz hands kind of seller. Like I'll go and kind of dance around and kind of do that thing. And obviously we're saying agencies who are creative. So like, that's part of it. We couldn't do that. And so I was like, look, we have a video solution here. When anyone signs up or comes into our lead funnel, let's just send them a video and welcome them on board. So the first piece of comms they had, we recorded a video for every person. I happened to take a ferry to Sydney, which went past the Opera House. So we had a pretty good background for it. And I do it on my mobile, which is where we played. And so the first piece of comms anyone would get would be a video from me saying, hey, John, saw you just signed up from Ogilvy in London. Obviously, I'm not in London, we're in Sydney, but I will be over there in 4 weeks' time. See you, like you run the Budweiser account. You know, we've worked with Tiger Beer and Heineken doing this kind of research. You know, love to come and share some insights with you. And we tripled our response rate. People loved it. The fact we'd taken the time for them, and obviously we were video, we were showing video off. We got every single meeting.
Wow.
And every single meeting, we got more business and kind of we went from there. We then moved that company eventually to the UK because it was just easier for time zones.
Yeah.
This solution we built where we would send people video messages to welcome them on board. Inevitably, one of those clients asked if they could use it for their clients. We built a solution over a weekend they could test out. Two of their clients then came in and asked if they could use it. So we put them on board. We put a sign-up form and actually overtook the original company within about 12 to 18 months. And I think maybe 6 to 8 months in, me and my CTO moved onto it full-time as a project. Mm. It was always a side project.
Yeah.
It had all the pieces of a SaaS starting to fit together, whereas the other company was starting to look more like an agency because although it was built on technology, it involved sales and projects and creativity, which was fine. And to be honest, because it was services plus products, it was a little bit different.
Yeah.
But for me, the idea of building a SaaS and building pure product that kind of onboarded like large funnels was pretty exciting. So we jumped on it, we took the opportunity, we invested in it heavily, it overtook the company in 12 to 18 months, and we moved the original company to the UK, put a different team in, it's got a different culture. I still sit on the board for it, but day-to-day operations, it's not me. And again, it needs to build like research versus what we do in Bonjour. Very different industries, very different. One's inbound, one's outbound. One's a very serious brand or more serious brand. One's not serious at all. They're very different companies, even though they share kind of a methodology and technology.
You know, you're absolutely right. And it is fascinating to see the deep expertise in a certain category and how that will most likely, it doesn't always, but it tends to lead us into a startup that we find success in. And I love that Bonjour is a success story out of another company that did find success as well. You saw an opportunity to use it for internal efforts, and then they started getting traction and saw the ability to turn into a SaaS. So now that we're in the Bonjour chapter, for those that may not know what Bonjour is, can you unpack for us, what is Bonjour?
Yeah, So it's an extension of that original idea. So it's one-to-one personalized video messaging, and it's videos that are sent to customers at or leads at certain points on the funnel. So we'll plug into any CRM or ESP you use, HubSpot, Salesforce, Intercom, even Shopify. And then when you have a new lead come in or a customer purchase for the first time or they hit whatever trigger you want, we notify you. We give you all the customer's information. So we show you where they're from, what they've done in your system, what their job title is. And we say that this is a great time to send a personalized video to this individual and welcome them on board or drive a demo or ask them to go and do X, Y, Z in the platform they haven't done. And so you pull out your phone or your desktop, do a video, takes 30 seconds to that individual, and then we deliver that to them and drive actions off the back of it. That's kind of the system within a very simple nutshell.
That's incredible. Absolutely. I love it because video is so critical. I mean, I think most people, including myself, until I became aware of Bonjoro, I think most people view video from a content perspective. We know the value of it from a lead generation perspective. We know the value of it from a sales process and how it can really drive and convert. But we tend to think of it, to your point, back in the day, as entertainment or a content piece. But to use it and bring it into our sales process, I don't think we tend to think about video that way. And yet, because of your internal needs, you actually did see the opportunity in this, inside of this. And so as you're starting Bonjoro as a separate entity now, as you're building on it, you had to then also too think of it a bit differently than you were for the internal solution or for the client that you were just creating a one-off for. What were some of the learnings you took from your previous ventures as you came into Bonjoro and said, how do we truly build this out as a SaaS solution that can go global?
I would actually say, and my team don't like me saying this, but we're not a video company. We're an engagement communication company. So video is a medium. I think this year has shown that it's a ubiquitous medium.
Yes.
Like everyone's going to be using it everywhere. Yes. It's not like video is no longer like a company. Like we're not a video company. We're using it in a certain way. And I think the thread through everything we've done was always video, not as a content form. So video like has always had this pedestal, movie and film, which is the reason why people find it nervous to get on video. Whereas if you think about it logically, it doesn't make sense because you don't find it nervous sitting down having coffee with someone. And this video is just a window, the same thing. So I think it was always on this pedestal. Even back to that original idea with the family stories, it was unedited, just raw like pieces of comms coming from the family. The second one was all about research and using it, again, to hear from people and see through their eyes. The third one is just about connecting with customers. So that's the thread that goes through it, is that video is more than just a film medium. It's more than the concept. It is a communication medium, the same as text is. It's much, much, much better. So understanding that then opens up an entire world of where you can use video and where it can go. But it's, again, understanding it's not about perfect content. It's about speaking to people. And this is the medium that helps us do that. And it's not about looking your best or perfect timing or editing or spending money. It is so much more than that. And so that's where it comes to. In terms of building a SaaS, what that comes down to is like having a predictable business model is amazing. It's a machine. You're basically building a machine where inputs come in the top and then you try and get as many outputs at the bottom, aka revenue. And so you're working at this machine, you're fixing the funnel and you're editing parts and you're building better products. And I mean, that to me is exciting. Like maybe it's the engineering part of my head. I'm like, we're basically making a living machine. The interesting thing is, you know, other than the difference to like the product design piece, is this is a machine that grows in complexity over time. It's not you're building multiple machines or multiple products. It's one piece that just starts to get crazy big, which makes it hard. But I love the predictability. I love being able to tweak and tell, you know, which obviously you do in other businesses. But I think with a SaaS, with a very inbound self-service product-led SaaS, it's fun.
Is Bonjoro something that for someone who, because you talked about integration with a lot of different platforms, for the solopreneur that doesn't have a need for Salesforce, or maybe they have a Shopify, but they don't have a platform per se, is it a standalone solution that can be plugged in with various automation triggers to still leverage for their business? Or is it something that is always plugged into a platform?
So it can be used standalone. If you don't plug it in, the chance of you becoming an active user are much lower.
Okay.
And this is one of the learnings from the first business, is how do you activate and how do you get habitual use? So what we found is that obviously having a process to do things in business means things get done. So if it's used, you know, oh, I meet someone at an event, I'm going to send them a video tomorrow and kind of just say thanks for connecting. Or I randomly reach out to a customer and do this. So you can build automations like a thank you Thursday that randomly picks a customer every Thursday, tells you to send a video thank you to them. that kind of thing can work. But again, you're being reminded every Thursday. If you have to get remember yourself, you will get distracted. Like, we all get busy. So the automations, it could plug into anything. So if you're using the smallest email system in the world, we have a lot of MailChimp users. It can plug into anything you use. We go through Zapier, so you can plug into anything there. So you need to have some automation, I think, for these to work. Again, we have customers who are very active who don't do that, but they have internal processes. Like, we work with a lot of school camps who will have campaigns, and non-profits, we have campaigns and drives at a certain time of year, and they know that they're gonna make video part of that. But that happens in January, and then here's the thing, and they go and do it, and off they go.
Got it.
So I think when you're building, maybe this applies to every business, if you can build habitual use in, and if you can take the thinking as much away from people as possible, then you are likely to be more successful. Like, yeah, this is one of the pieces that makes you likely to be more successful. There's a million others.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, that habitual use, if you get that, it's key.
That's interesting. So learning this process, that tells me, as you're building out Bonjoro, your onboarding process was probably something you spent a tremendous amount of time on, because the key factor was getting them to integrate it into some of their processes. Because I can't imagine part of your onboarding process is to create habit in someone else's life. It's probably to integrate into their existing processes. And so your onboarding process is it really hands-on, or are you keeping everything at an online automated format?
It's online. It's quite a bit of setup for the user. So one of the first things we ask you to do is to connect into your CRM, which is a fairly big ask. I mean, it's much easier today with the way that things connect.
Yep.
But we ask you that. We ask you then, you know, to set up, like, to customize your videos and to make sure it's sending from your email. These are quite big hurdles for customers to do. Now, and there's different schools of thought here, but our school of thought is, look, having those hurdles is going to knock more users out the funnel, but it means if they come through, they're going to be more committed. So again, this is about working with a funnel.
Yeah.
Two things are, you have extremely light touch and you get a lot of users in, and then you try to educate over a long time. The other thing is having high barriers. So the ones that make it through, you can guarantee are more likely to convert. We've tested both. We found the second one more effective in terms of overall output for the company. We continue to test. So I mean, this is the thing, like, the system we have right now, it's definitely not the best way of doing it, because that would be it's impossible to know what that is. So the only thing you do is to keep trying and testing. And obviously, as you grow and that funnel grows, you have more data that helps support this. You get more savvy, you talk to more customers. But at the same point, the creative side, there could be a way of onboarding customers that we haven't even considered that is completely different, that doesn't involve any of that, that might be doubly effective. So, I mean, this is exciting.
Yeah.
But again, where we are today, we found that works. We've started to be a bit more hands-on with customers if they need it. So we've only started to really do calls with customers in the last 6 months with larger teams. And we found that that works. I mean, everything you ever do in business, you do it and you think, wish we'd done that 6 months ago.
Yeah. Everything is like that.
Everything, without a fail.
When would you consider Bonjoro's start date? Like, what is your launch date when you think of Bonjoro?
So 2017 is early 2017, we put it out with a sign up form on it, but it was a side project at the time. We still count that as our launch date for sure.
Got it. So 2017, consider your launch date. What has been the capitalization for it? Have you gone venture backed? Have you been profitable from day one when you spun out of that company? What has been the funding process for it?
We did raise some funds. Okay. We raised a seed fund here in Oz, about $1 million, okay. Australian. Maybe a year, maybe 18 months in, I think, when we started to go into it full time.
Okay.
And then we went short for profitability after that. So yeah, we kind of had a bit of a different mindset of going to break even with it. And we will look at funding again. And probably not in Australia, because 90% of our customers are overseas. Again, like, Australia, I love living here. Even today, because it had that delay on, like, investing in tech, even today, it's like, I was still like, compared to the rest of the world, it's a very immature market. So great start here.
Yeah.
I think it helps that a lot of us are non-Australians. Like, we have quite a diverse team. The team's actually based in 6 different countries around the world. We're only 14 people, so we're not a huge team.
Yeah.
But we're kind of dotted around, and we've done that from day one. And so that mindset for us is, we're not an Australian company. Just the founders happen to live here.
That's awesome. I love it. So your seed fund is it so far. That's remarkable. I love those stories of taking what little capital they can, stretch it as far as they can, reach for profitability first. I love that. I mean, again, I think sometimes we glamorize venture capital. Let's glamorize profitability. Let's glamorize self-sustaining cash flow. Let's glamorize those things. And so, but there is something to be said about venture capital when you've got all the dials figured in and you're just ready to scale at that point. Obviously, I think, I assume at that point, that's when you'll start considering venture capital, is when you really just kind of go off and scale.
In stages, yeah. Like the first stage is survival. The second stage is where can we deploy this capital back to the funnel, where I know if I put $1 million in, I'm going to get $5 million out.
Yeah.
I know that, and I can guarantee that, and I have the ducks in the road to do that. Then it starts to make sense again. And then it's very attractive for investors too.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So in your 3 years now of Bonjoro being a standalone company since its launch, what have been moments along the journey that you realized, wait a second, we actually have something right now? Like, has there been that moment where you're like, okay, we know we are onto something and this thing is going to succeed? And conversely, has there been moments where you thought, I don't think we're going to be able to pull this off?
No, definitely the first one, because it wasn't, I think the difference here is that, you know, we didn't go out and build the strategy around building a business and go and launch them. Did we hit the strategy? Did we hit the numbers? It was a side project that starts to take off. And so that makes it challenging, because then you're like, what is the global vision of the company? Because this wasn't really a company. Yeah. And yeah. Then you have to like backtrack and be like, what is it we're even doing here? Like is this video? Is this not video? Like, what even, like, is the core concept? Where can we take this? And there's 100 different directions there. Do you become a video platform? Do you go into customer success? Like, do you go into engagement? So that is difficult doing it that way. But at the same point, it means that it's kind of all upside because it was never expected. And so 6 months in, so we moved in. It's between 6 and 12 months, me and my CTO kind of jumped in full time, and we were very binary. I think the other business, to be fair, was running well without me, without us. And we literally took a step one day. Again, we went from a side project to a full-time project very, very quickly. I think we saw those levers, and the experience was there that we understood that those levers were genuine levers. We understood they were real. We understood how valuable they were. And even now, you look back, you're like, wish done it 6 months before. But again, running two businesses, I would not recommend.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, it's hard to sell. So it made sense pretty early on. We went in, it just kept growing. I think, you know, early on, being able to fundraise, even though it's only a seed, validates that as well, that others have confidence in it. Mm-hmm. Getting to break even validates it once again. Look, the barrier, I don't know what true validation is, because the barriers always move. You get to like, you know, some big revenue hurdle, and you think you're going to celebrate, and you get there and you're like, we need to double this, like, as quickly as possible. So like, yeah. Do we ever get a validation? What does validation mean? I don't know if we'll ever sit down and be like, we are satisfied.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's a great question, because, and I don't know if this is the answer to it, but I reflect back on my interview with Ben Chestnut, the founder of MailChimp. And he talks about his period of time in 2007. I think it was 2007, 2006, when Constant Contact had gone public. Venture capital was chasing MailChimp or any other email service provider out there because they saw what Constant Contact had done. And people weren't coming to MailChimp right away. And so he had this, almost like this, this vanity moment where he was bothered that venture capital wasn't coming to MailChimp. And he's like, where's my headlines? Like, what, you know, we've created, you know, X hundreds of millions of dollars with no venture capital. Where's my headlines at? Where's my vanity moment? And he realized, wait a second, all this validation I'm looking for, I have customers opening their wallets. Like, that's the validation I need. I don't need headlines. I don't need venture capital to validate this. I have customers who are paying for my service. That's my validation. And so from that point on, they have not taken any venture capital. They're $5 billion valuation. Like, it's crazy. And it's been bootstrapped from the get-go because he had a moment where he flipped the switch and said, the only validation I'm going to seek is customers paying. And I was like, that's awesome. So again, I don't know if it's the answer, but I love it.
And I agree, yeah. Like, I think, so like the whole venture capital thing, double-edged swords, there's absolute value in it, but there's also value. Like, so yeah, like MailChimp did it. I think Campaign Monitor here, their first thing they ever raised was $60 million, like in the same space. Oh, very, very similar. They were like the Aussie MailChimp, they're like agency, spell out email, off they went. Another company, HootKit, Vero in the email space. And then like, now you've got like ConvertKit have done it, like DesignPickle. There's other companies that have done it without funding. And I think those companies are inspirational. They're far more inspirational than anyone who's raised money.
Yes.
Because the other thing is, like, to do that, they have more stable businesses because they had to make revenue to get there. And so like, I'd like to see us more like them. That's why we had a bit of an internal thing for like, let's get to break even and prove that we can do it. And prove the business is a real business.
Yeah.
In my mind, it's not just a propped up funded business. We'll raise if we want to for the right reasons. if we could do it without raising and we could hit the same numbers, then we won't raise. It'll just be a case of timing, speed. I mean, there's a lot of different factors. Yeah. But like, hats off to anyone who does it without. Like, I think those are the true... MailChimp have the headlines above anyone else, you ask me.
I am such a MailChimp evangelist. Like, I love Ben's story. I love the way they handle small businesses. And I see Bonjoro in its very early stage fitting in that same spot with MailChimp from the ability to just truly deliver for small businesses. And again, I know this is not part of your marketing as much as it is for MailChimp, but MailChimp has really positioned themselves in this space where they have come alongside businesses in order for them for messaging, right? And yours is very much the same. Like, you have the ability to come alongside businesses and help them when it comes to lead conversion, right? And so what I'd like to do right now for all of the founders that are listening now, all the people that are operating businesses, the idea of leveraging a video solution, an engagement solution leveraging video, if you will, for lead conversion. Can you walk us through what that looks like and how can Bonjoro help with that?
So using Bonjoro, ultimately what you're doing with leads is making a best first impression. So we're using video to do this because video is the full spectrum of communication. So you get the emotion across, you get who you are, but more importantly, you get to connect with customers one-on-one. It's transparency and it shows that you're willing to take time with any lead that comes in. Now to use this, if you're using a system, an active campaign, Salesforce, HubSpot, Intercom, whatever you use for your CRM, whatever you use to manage your leads coming in, if you plug Bonjoro into that, we will notify you when leads come into your funnel. We'll notify you or certain members of your team. Now the system will actually pull in information about that customer. So if Joe Blog signs up from Orlando and works for X company, we'll pull that in and we'll tell you and say, hey, look, Joe Blog from X company just signed up. We'll also tell you what he's done in your system. So we'll say, look, he signed up, he's gone through onboarding, but he hasn't completed step X. We'll even tell you what his lead score is, how valuable a customer he is, and whether, you know, you should potentially go and look to talk to him. You'll get a notification, you or your team members, mobile, if you're on the move or desktop, you simply hit record and record a message for Joe. So obviously welcoming him on board, saying, look, I saw you sign up. I saw you've done steps 1, 2, 3. I saw you haven't done step 5, which is really important. Here's a link to go into that step, because if you get that across, you'll be successful in the product. Or if you'd like to book a demo, there's also a demo booking link. One of our team will hop on a call and talk you through. Thanks so much for coming on board. Wonderful to have you. Any questions at all, please reach out. We're here to help. That's it. Like a 20-second video. You press send, you go back to work. Now we deliver that to Joe. We'll send it out to him. It'll include links that you mentioned. You can choose different links to different customers. And what we'll see is that the average Joe will reply 3 times as much as they would do to a normal generic automated email they get when they sign up. So I think first point of contact is so powerful because it's your chance to make the best first impression.
Yeah.
And anyone coming in, and I will argue this is from pretty much any industry, if you show that you're willing to stop in your day and acknowledge that customer, there's a lot of power in name, a lot of power in saying their company name, a lot of power in just showing that you actually have support as an excellence, you know, in your company, the law of reciprocation will kick in and this person is far more likely to come back to you and say, wow, did not expect that. Actually, I do need help. Can we hop on a call?
I love it.
So what you're trying to do here is really to build a micro relationship with anyone who's interested. And you're also capturing people who would potentially bounce out because they didn't understand the onboard, like you didn't understand the company.
Yeah.
They might get distracted. You're showing them that you're there to help. And it's much harder to turn down a human than it is to turn down, again, a generic email. And the idea of personalization as well, it's these 2 points of hard to turn them down and the fact that there is someone there and that they are a good company and the ethos comes through and the transparency. That's a company you kind of want to work with that you will trust to help you out when things get tough.
That's awesome. And one of the things you mentioned in our conversation was the use case inside of Shopify, right? You plug into Shopify. I can absolutely see a Bonjoro solution in some type of B2B environment, or I guess even B2C. I mean, if I'm a contractor, a pool contractor, right? Someone comes in with the lead, I can absolutely see all of this, whether it is a one-to-one sale. How does this work inside of e-commerce?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. I think you'll see e-commerce. So e-commerce has changed a lot in the last 12 months.
Even, yeah, so absolutely.
So in e-commerce, the concept of lifetime value is starting to kind of rise as it used to in SaaS and in other companies. And lifetime value is basically how much money will a customer give you over their lifetime. So if they buy a widget off you for $100, but they come back in 6 months and buy another one, and 6 months another and buy another one, they're not a $100 customer, they're a $300 customer minimal. If they come back for 20 years, they're potentially a $5,000 customer. So understanding that repeat purchase and what that customer means in terms of absolute value is kind of key to this. If you start thinking this way, then it's no longer about single sales. E-commerce becomes about repeat purchasing and lifetime value of customers. So back to what we talked about with sales, building a relationship with that customer, showing them that you're different to your competitors, showing them that you're an e-commerce company who cares about customers and cares about support when your competitors don't, because anyone can sell the same products and you will have competition. This is something to stand out. So where we get used for things like shopping cart completions. So if those don't complete, checking in, making sure people are okay, asking if they need help. We get used a lot for referrals and advocacy as a byproduct. So people wait until the product's been delivered, wait 24 hours, send a video, say, hey Jenny, I saw you bought X dress. I just want to make sure it arrived and that it's exactly what you expected. So this part is the customer service excellence. Again, if that person has an issue, they're going to come to you extremely happy and positive rather than being negative.
Yeah.
So you're showing that you're there to help them and support them. And then you say, if it was everything you expected and you enjoy it, would you mind leaving us a review? Here's a link to Trustpilot. So off the back of this, the other thing is you take that positivity and you use it to drive more traffic through reviews or through case studies or through anything else that comes through. So essentially, you're trying to reduce your cost per acquisition by using your existing customer base. Show them you're an amazing company, show them get those positive reactions, and then leverage those to drive more customers into the funnel.
Absolutely love that. That is remarkable. It's funny, as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, of all my e-commerce transactions, I can't think of a single time that someone has leveraged something unique that has driven me to actually write a review. The emails, I just disregard. I get so many emails, but if someone were to send me a Bonjoro, that's a game changer. So my mind is just, my wheels are spinning on how I can bring it into the latest launch of our coffee subscription, Grindology. I can really see some value inside of leveraging a Bonjoro for that. So that's quite remarkable. But when we think of the growth of Bonjoro and the trajectory of Bonjoro, if we're having a Where Are They Now episode in 5 years, where will Bonjoro be? Where do you see Bonjoro in 3 to 5 years from now?
Yeah, so we have an ethos that kind of drives the vision, which is automate processes, but never relationships. Mm. So really what we're about here, again, so we're not a video company. We are a personalization at scale company, and we're trying to ultimately turn customers into advocates or super fans. That end goal, that is the holy grail. So can we help you be more effective at generating relationships with customers? Can we help you be more effective at generating these advocates? And then can we help you leverage them? Yeah, so the e-commerce is a good example. Driving reviews. The other thing is, can we make sure that every single customer you ever have has a wonderful experience, has the best experience of any company they've ever dealt with through the way that you engage with them? And then can we take that positivity and get them to drive you more customers? And that's kind of our goal with the company, is what other methodologies can we use to do this? Video is great. It's one touch point. What else can we do that's kind of unique and unexpected and delightful on a customer journey? Can we tell you when you should be reaching out? Can we tell you when to invest your time in customers, which customers you should invest in? This customer is much more likely to convert if you send a video at this time. This customer fits your best customers. You should spend more time on them than this customer. And here's some tools to go and do that. Once you've done that, here's some tools to make sure that customer leaves you a review or a case study or drives you new traffic, because we know they will do, because we've flagged them as an advocate or super fan. So that idea of helping you create the best personalized, genuine experiences for customers, and then use those as a growth lever for the company.
Oh my goodness. I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. I just happened to glance at our time, and as our time's coming to an end, I want to make sure I know all the value that you've delivered to my audience. And I'm just so grateful for your time here on the show, but I want to honor the time of our audience as well and get to the final three questions that I ask every founder. And that first one has to do with just the perspective of entrepreneurship. You've had an interesting journey leading up to Bonjoro. One that might be considered an unintentional entrepreneurial journey that has led in certain ways. And ways we look back, I reflect on, I can see it being very intentional. But when you think to the idea of entrepreneurship and how the media has glamorized certain elements of it, do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur? Not want to be, not everyone wants to be an entrepreneur, but should they desire it, do you think anyone can be an entrepreneur?
I would say probably not. I think it takes a certain mindset. It takes the way that you satisfy yourself. So if this curve you want as steep as possible, it's an awesome way to go. If you don't, you have other priorities, which might be family or lifestyle, then maybe not, because there are the highs, but there are probably a lot more lows. It's a wild ride. Having a wife and family, I would hate for them to go into it and experience at the same time. So it's nice to have stability with a partner. So I don't think it's particularly for everyone. I think it has been glamorized. I think you need to do what suits you as an individual. And as long as you're content, that's awesome.
I had one of our past guests say, entrepreneurship is a lot more about temperament than it is skill set.
Exactly.
It is. I couldn't agree more. And one of the things about entrepreneurship and about the fact that it's been glamorized, part of the persona of entrepreneurship is that it's this isolated journey. It's just a matter of you sleeping on someone's couch and a laptop and just hacking away at code to deliver some solution and trying to do the marketing via online. But it's just you and your computer, and you can do this all by yourself. And while those stories have been proven true, they're the anomaly and not the norm. And so when we look back at your entrepreneurial journey from the very beginning, who are all the people you point to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to your journey?
So team, and then obviously investors as well, and mentors throughout the journey, you know, from the first company I worked for, the mentors there, to going into learning how to network and sell into some investors and mentors we had in the early days, and to like our new investors now and where they are. You need the people around you. It's not a solo journey. Yeah. I actually run a group of 250 founders in tech in Sydney now because of that need to have other people around you. Bringing people who are in the same, like who are doing the same journey and challenges to support you, because as much as I love my family, they don't understand.
Yeah. You know? 100%. I mean, you're absolutely correct. And that's why I asked that question, because I think the more times I ask it, and the more times other founders preach to the idea that you need other entrepreneurs to kind of connect and brainstorm and ideate around, the more that persona of this lone ranger goes away. And I just want people to understand, like, it will break you if you try to do this solo. Connect with other entrepreneurs. And so with that said, one of the things that I wish I could afford all of my listeners is a chance to connect with my incredible founder guests like yourself. But alas, I can't. It's been near impossible. Can't arrange 85,000 coffee dates with you to bring some of their most challenging questions to. But I would like to afford what I call the mentoring minute. So as much as we can play the role, if you were to have a coffee with one of my listeners, and maybe it's the entrepreneur who's just constantly dealing with cash flow struggles and not quite sure that they think it's just them and their ability to execute, and they're about ready to just give it up because they can't handle the turmoil. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur who's got a book full of dreams and ideas, but there's some narrative, maybe they're 50 years old, and the idea that most entrepreneurs are in their 20s and 30s, that they think entrepreneurship's not for them. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur that had a business, but COVID has absolutely decimated it, and they're about ready to call it quits. Whoever that may be, if you were having coffee with one of my listeners, what would you say to them?
It's a tough journey for all of us. I don't think anyone has it easy. Again, I wouldn't be taken in by the entrepreneurship work. Like, I call it business. It's business. Like, you're no different to the generation before you. They did it, and they probably did it a lot harder than you've done it. It is tough. There is a point when it's good to stop, but then you can always start again. Tomorrow is another day. When I have a bad day, and I have them for sure, I tend to just switch off. I will go to sleep, because I know that tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll be smiling again, because there's as much opportunity tomorrow as was on the very first day I started the company. And you'll find that too. So if when you're having a hard time, talk to friends, switch off, relax. Tomorrow's another day. There is a million things you could do. So keep going.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Matt Barnett brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So please visit Bonjoro.com and take them up on their free trial offer. Within minutes, you can integrate Bonjoro into your marketing and sales processes and see the value it can deliver to your business before you spend a single dime. It really is zero risk opportunity. So make sure to visit Bonjoro.com. I say it in every episode because I believe it with my very being. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. And Bonjoro is a startup. So let's show up for Matt Barnett and the Bonjoro team in a huge way as a way of saying thank you for all the value he delivered to us today. And now for my personal ask.
The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.